From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We humans have a very long relationship with sugar. 10,000 years ago, we figured out how to domesticate it, and it wasn't long before we created stories and myths that included sweet stuff. The journalist Rich Cohen says in one of these myths, we got the human race when the first man made love to a stalk of sugarcane, which makes a kind of sense when you think about our relationship with sugar today. We love it. Today in the program, we're talking about that relationship. We'll start with the history part. How is it we came to be so dependent on sugar? But the crucial question is, what is sugar doing to us? Recent research is showing us it's more than just making us fat. One of our guests today says when you eat enough of it, sugar is a poison. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's nothing new in the idea that sugar is bad for you, but most of the time what we mean by that is that it can make you fat. So if it makes us gain weight, we just eat less of it. It's pretty simple. Well, more and more research is showing it's, in fact, not that simple, that sugar does things to the body. More studies are showing that it causes fat in the liver, for example. It causes insulin resistance, which contributes to obesity and hypertension and diabetes and heart disease, maybe even cancer. There's a new study from the University of Utah which suggests sugar isn't even healthy at supposedly safe doses. In fact, one of our guests today says sugar is a toxin. We're talking about sugar today. You can join the conversation if you have comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We're going to first begin, though, to try to trace back our relationship, our history with sugar. And joining us to help us do that is Rich Cohen, the author of 10 books, including Sweet and Low, A Family Story. His writing has appeared in a number of magazines and newspapers. His article, Sugar Love, A Not-So-Sweet Story, appears in the August issue of the National Geographic magazine. And Rich Cohen is joining us by phone from his home in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And Rich Cohen, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to start with your article is compelling in the sense that it talks about our sort of the historical relationship with it. You say that sugar seems to have first been domesticated on an island in New Guinea about 10,000 years ago?
Yeah, well, my research, you know, it goes back to the beginning of sugar as we know it today. I'm sort of really interested in origins and how the things we take for granted, how they started. Sugarcane was just something growing, and people would pull it down and suck on it until they tasted the sweet thing in it. And finally, someone figured out, prehistoric times, how to refine it so you could basically boil it down to the essential thing that made it sweet, which is sucrose, which in its most refined form is table sugar, and it's white, and it was sort of a secret science. You know, if you could do this, it was like a miracle. It's like taking the soul out of a body, you know, to take the sweet thing out of sugarcane. And that knowledge of how to do that spread slowly. You can almost imagine like a shadow going from the east to the west, first into Asia, into India, eventually into Persia.
Yeah.
And when the Arab conquest of Persia happened, 600-800 AD, one of the things that armies took away from Persia was this knowledge of sugarcane itself and the refining, and they brought it all the way, you know, to the Middle East and to North Africa where they had huge plantations. And Europe, there was no sugar, really, and the European diet was basically three courses of gruel,
right,
which is pretty miserable.
Right.
And during the Crusades, Christian soldiers went into the Middle East and they tasted sugar. And if you've been living on three courses of gruel, you taste sugar, it's like a pretty unbelievable thing, you know?
Yeah.
And they brought it back to Europe, and like in Britain, it was really of something for the royals, and it was so rare that it was considered a spice, like cinnamon. And there was this huge appetite for it. It's like a bauble. It's like caviar.
Mm.
And the more they had it, the more they wanted. The more they wanted, the more they got. The more they got, the more they had. And eventually it went down and was had by very rich people and aristocrats until over time it worked its way into the middle classes, completely changed the diet. suddenly you had pudding and the possibility of future Pink Floyd songs. And then ultimately, you know, when I went to school, I grew up in Chicago, and we studied the Age of Exploration as Columbus-driven and the people after him by pure knowledge of discovery and wanting to know what was on the other side of the world. When you look at it through sugar, you see what the Age of Exploration was, in no small part, was a sugar boom.
Yeah.
And it's like the similar to us searching for sources of energy now. People were searching for islands where they could plant sugarcane. Sugarcane needed the tropics, and it was an incredibly tough thing to grow and refine, and ultimately to really work and be profitable, it needed slaves.
Yeah.
And really the story of the sugar trade is wrapped up in the story of the Atlantic slave trade. And if you look at the Atlantic slave trade, a full 50% of all the people brought to the Western Hemisphere in chains as slaves wound up on sugar plantations.
Mm. So sugar drives the slave trade, and as you're reporting your story, slavery doesn't, in fact, one historian said this, slavery doesn't come from racism so much as racism is a consequence of slavery. I mean, it was a way to justify the practice to keep the early sugar trade, you know, propped up. So I guess it could be said sugar is in part to blame for racism in this part of the world.
Yeah, if you look at it that way. I mean, that kind of blew my mind. I mean, when there was sugar plantations in North Africa that were Arab sugar plantations, they also were run by slaves, because that's the only person that would work on a sugar plantation was somebody who was made to work on a sugar plantation.
Yeah.
And had no choice. And in the case of North Africa, it was Europeans from Eastern Europe who'd been taken as prisoners of war. And one sort of legend has it that the word slave itself comes from the word Slav. That's who was working on sugar plantations. And I came across a historian who sort of completely inverts what we think of as history in saying that, like you said, it's not that Africans were seen as inferior and taken as slaves. It's that Europeans needed some way to justify the slave taking they needed to do to make the sugar industry work. So they invented the whole myth of inferiority.
Mm. It's hard to imagine life without sugar. So you mentioned in Western Europe, for example, everyday existence then is mostly, you mentioned gruel, but everything is savory, right? Until, I mean, for people before sugar, there's no sweets, there's no desserts. Did we think about food differently once sugar came in? You know, now there's dessert, now there's something sweet. Did we start thinking about food in a different way, more than just as nutrition, but as something even more pleasurable, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, there was, of course, honey, and there was fruit. And there were, you know, good things, but I think that really with the coming of spices and sugar, you know, sugar started as, like I said, a spice. It became a staple where people were getting a large amount of their sustenance from it. It ultimately does change the whole relationship to food, where now, I mean, I've never really gotten in with this, so there's whole industry of kind of like just dedicated to very extreme foods. You know, it becomes kind of a pornography of food, you know, where people pay $3,000-$4,000 to have meals. I mean, it becomes the center of everything is the meal you're going to have. And as soon as you finish lunch, you start planning for dinner. So, I mean, but in a way, I mean, sugar makes life more pleasurable and it sustains a lot of people because it does give you a lot of calories at a very small dose. But very early on, there's noticeable medical effects, which is diabetes didn't exist in Europe, or if it did exist, you wouldn't know because there wasn't sugar. And you immediately start having problems with diabetes, and you have problems with teeth and tooth decay. You know, so you pay a price. I guess you have to go with the old saying that there is no free lunch.
Right. So you say that there were studies that showed sugar being, you know, the culprit for heart disease and diabetes early on, but the high levels of fat and insulin in the blood. But you say that message really for a long time has been drowned out by this chorus of other scientists who blame it on too much saturated fat in the diet. Do you get a sense that that sensibility is changing some?
I do. I mean, it's interesting. I think it's a pretty recent thing of like the last 30 years. We were always told, you know, that fat was the problem. Fat was the cause of heart disease. And And we avoided fat to the point where if you go to the candy store right now, you can buy a package of Chuckles, one of my favorite candies, and it will say no fat, like you're buying a health food, you know.
Yeah.
Healthiest thing you could do is live on Chuckles and licorice. And what happened is because for good intentions, a lot of food manufacturers, people took fat out of their diet, and in a lot of cases what it was replaced with was sugar. And now it turns out that a lot of the original problem we associated with fat is actually caused by sugar. So it's like the ultimate, it's like almost a textbook definition of irony, which is the very thing you're trying to avoid, which is heart disease, you run right into the arms of because of your solution. And you wind up getting sick by eating foods you don't even like. So it's sort of like if you're going to go down, I'd rather go down with something I enjoy. So I guess I'm saying order a steak tonight.
Right. You ask an intriguing question. Why is it that our brains, why would they evolve to respond to something that people are saying is a toxin? Why would we respond with such pleasure to something that, in fact, is a toxin? And you talk about that in the article. I wanted you to say something about that.
Well, I spent a lot of time for this story with a doctor named Richard Johnson, who's in Colorado, and we talked a lot about that. And his thinking is that there was a time, we were just talking about it, when sugar was incredibly, incredibly rare. And it was an evolutionary advantage for our bodies to be able to turn a tiny little bit of sugar into fat that could be stored and help us survive the winter, the years, whatever. And our bodies became like the equivalent of a car that could go 200 miles on a gallon of gas, which was key in a time when there was no gas around. Mm. That being sugar. Now we're sort of swimming in an ocean of it, and we're imbibing it when we don't even know we're imbibing it, which is really the problem. I mean, no-fat yogurt with fruit will have more sugar than a can of Coke. And it's sort of like our bodies are adapted for a different world. And as far as it being a toxin, I mean, we craved it because it kept us alive through the winter, if you will. And as far as it being a toxin, you'll have people talking about it, but my sense was that it was a toxin, you know, only when had in massive doses. So a little bit, it was actually an advantage. A lot is a real problem, and almost everybody is now having a lot. I mean, you went from the Middle Ages in Europe to the average person had no sugar, to now the average person is eating, you know, close to 77 pounds of sugar a year.
Mm. What kind of reaction are you getting? Do people get pretty sensitive when you start talking about, you know, their sugar? I mean, people are pretty
no,
tied
I think
to it.
I, you know, the reaction I've got for this story has been, it's like me. I have little kids, you know, and you want to do the right thing. You want to give them the right food. But a lot of times it's very, very hard because things are labeled in such a way and presented in such a way that sugar is almost impossible to get away from. You don't want to completely, me anyway, I'm talking for myself.
Yeah.
I don't want to prevent my kids from having sugar. I don't want to prevent them from having a piece of cake. You just want to know when they're eating what they're eating. You know, I believe in that thing, you are what you eat. What if you don't know what that is?
Yeah.
And that's the situation right now. I had a friend, my best friend when I was a little kid, his father was a dentist. He didn't let his kids eat sugar. They would come over to our house, and it was like a sailor on liberty. They'd go absolutely insane, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not what I want. I think that a moderate amount of sugar is good, and I think that a lot of people are reacting, you know, the same way that you were talking. You briefly touched on the fact that too much sugar consumption can actually damage your liver, make your liver fatty, because sucrose breaks into glucose and fructose when you eat it, and the fructose goes right to your liver, and your liver basically can't process it.
Yeah.
And the good news is, and that causes metabolic syndrome, which like a third of Americans have, which is you're on your way to type 2 diabetes. The good news is if you cut back and you stop, your liver mostly completely recovers. So it's kind of an optimistic thing because a lot of times there's things wrong and there's nothing you can do. In this case, there's actually something you can do about it.
That's Rich Cohen. He's the author and journalist. His article, Sugar Love, a Not-So-Sweet Story, appears in the August issue of the National Geographic. And you should get his book, Sweet and Low, a Family Story, which gives another kind of personal spin on this whole idea of sweet and sugar. And Rich joined us today from his home in Ridgefield, Connecticut. Rich, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sugar. And for a long time, the rap on sugar has been that, yes, it makes you fat, but, you know, it's empty calories. More and more research, though, is showing that sugar is not benign. In fact, it can be toxic, directly connected to diabetes and heart disease, maybe even cancer. Today in the program, we are talking about that, and we invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program is Wayne Potts. He's a professor of biology here at the University of Utah, senior author of a recent study, which I want to talk to them about, which looks at the consumption of safe sugar at supposedly safe levels. The report is published today in the journal Nature Communications. And Professor Potts, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We also have James Ruff. He's a postdoctoral researcher here at the university. He's the first author of the sugar study, which was part of his dissertation, in fact. And James Ruff, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So what got you – what was the – I guess I want to start with the thesis. What got you started thinking about this particular study, what you wanted to accomplish, what you wanted to find?
Well, it started when we did an inbreeding study for different purposes, and we wanted to know how bad inbreeding was in mice. And it had been done half a dozen times before. Everybody had found about a 10% effect. But we were suspicious because they all stopped at litter size measurements of this one generation of full sib inbreeding. And so we did our own study in these little semi-natural populations of mice. We did the one generation of full sib inbreeding, got the 10% effect, and then we took the progeny and made them compete against outbred progeny and discovered an additional 500% effect. The outbred males had five times more offspring than inbred males because they were able to win the competitions over territories, which gave them breeding rights. And so we said to ourselves, wow, this looks like it's a very sensitive assay for health and vigor declines, in this case due to inbreeding. But it seems to us that it could apply to any kind of treatment that you suspected might degrade health. And so one obvious place was in the realm of toxicity assessment. And so we went to our toxicology friends and asked for a substance that everybody was curious, suspicious about, but couldn't prove that it was toxic. And one of them suggested we do
sugar.
Sugar.
Yeah, yeah. That's a long prelude to the idea that you figured these mice, we could figure out how toxicity works on these mice, basically, right? Because I understood about a third of what you just said, I mean, in terms of some of the particulars. But I get it. I mean, I get the idea that this was a good population to be able to test this idea of toxicity. And somebody says sugar. And you were suspicious of the idea of sugar, at least at first?
Yeah, I thought we were going to be in the realm of pesticides or something that everybody was more suspicious about. And so it caught me by surprise, but we launched into it, and Jimmy took on the project as his dissertation.
And James, you were enthused by the idea? Sugar is the perfect thing to test?
Yeah, I was excited. I mean, I was a wide-eyed, naive graduate student right. ready to take on the world. And, you know, the idea came across, and, you know, I was ready to go. I don't think I predicted the outcome exactly, but I was definitely excited to put added sugar into our system.
Now, what seems to be really unique about this particular study is oftentimes when we're talking about studying the effects of sugar, a lot of times the doses that they give to experiment, you know, animal like rats or mice are incredibly high. What seems significant about your study is that these were so-called safe doses of sugar.
Yes, you know, it's typical for animal research to feed their rodents, you know, 50% of their calories from sugar, 60% of their calories from sugar, or even do 70% of calories from fructose, which, as the previous guest mentioned, is the bad player in sugar, which is completely not representative of what most people eat. And so we thought our system was incredibly sensitive, so we wanted to actually test levels that people are actively consuming. So we went with a diet that was 25% of calories coming from added sugar.
Okay. Why wouldn't this be obvious to researchers before, this idea that why do researchers pump such high doses into their – I mean, there's got to be some justification for it. And surely you can't be the first to say, let's not give them so much and see what the effects might be on. Do you know what I mean? That seems like such an obvious thing.
The pressures to publish suggest that you'd like to get an effect in a quick amount of time.
Huh.
And so by pushing the levels up, they get an effect they can measure and report.
Yeah.
And whereas down at the lower levels, ours is the first to actually show these adverse effects at these safe levels.
Yeah. Now, what do we mean by safe, James? 25%? I mean, it's hard to make the translations into human consumption, but I've heard you describe it as a couple of cans of Coke or something.
Yeah, so, you know, it's approximately three cans, 12-ounce cans of soda, which of course is, you know, very different than 1 liter bottle or 1 2-liter bottles of soda. And it is considered safe right now. The recommendation by the National Academy of Science, which then guides governmental policy in the United States, is that no more than 25% of one's calories should come from added sugar. So we decided to test that upper safe limit within this study. And also, you know, it's around 1 in 4, between 1 in 3 and 1 in, or 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 Americans are actually on this diet or above. So it is not some artificially inflated diet. This is what, you know, many of our listeners are eating every day.
Yeah. So how do you conduct a study like this? What do you do?
Well, the first thing we do is we start feeding the animals the diet.
Yeah.
And that takes place in standard laboratory cage system. When the mice are teenagers, when they're ready to be taken away from their parents, we put half of them on the added sugar diet and the other half on a sugar-free control diet. We then feed them that for a long period of time because we're interested in the chronic effects of sugar for 26 weeks, which brings our mice up to middle-aged individuals. Right? And at that point, that's when we release them into these enclosures, these pens, these semi-natural environments that really emulate or model mouse nature.
Yeah.
Mouse nature is the basement. It's fantastic. It's really easy to replicate. So you put them in the basement. You put them in a room, and you put half of the individuals are on the added sugar diet and half are on the control diet. And then you just ask, hey, do these mice that were fed sugar do as well? Do they live as long? Do they have as many offspring over their life? Do they acquire territories? Are they good at, you know, those day-to-day competitions relative to the control individuals? And those are the things we measured.
And you found, in fact, I mean, were you surprised by the fact that, in fact, it had a pretty powerful effect on these behaviors?
Yeah, it is relatively stunning. I mean, one of the big findings is that female mice on the added sugar diet experienced twice the death rate in these enclosures. Right, the male effects were not mortality, but the males that were fed the added sugar were less likely to be winners. They couldn't win a territory. And if
now, what does that mean? So I guess this refers to their ability to fight over a particular section or a particular female or something?
So mice are highly territorial. So the males kind of set up shop in a good area where there's food, where there's water, where there's shelter, and then they actively exclude other males. And they put their heart and soul into this day in and day out, just kind of chasing away competitors. And every day the competitors come back in and try to take it. Because, you know, if a male does not have a territory, female mice will not mate with them. So it's incredibly important to do this. Mm-hmm. And they put everything they've got into this every day. And what we found was the ones we fed added sugar to couldn't cut it. They occupied 25% fewer territories than the control individuals. And then that led to a 25% reduction in reproduction.
Well. Yeah. Did it mean they were weaker or just less aggressive?
You know, it's not the same thing as aggression. Aggression is kind of like, you know, are you going to start the fight? Right. Their ability to finish the fight is what is interesting. And it's, you know, these aren't all out brawls per se. They're just day to day testing repeated. And, you know, the problem could be anywhere. The problem can be their muscles aren't as effective. It could be in their cognition skills, their hand-paw coordination, if you will. There's just defects in the animals that are fed out of sugar that make them not capable to do the things that mice need to do to be successful.
So you don't necessarily know that yet. You'd have to do more studies to find out why it is that they're not holding the territory. What you did find is, in fact, that they just aren't.
Correct. And, you know, we looked in the obvious spots, right? Before they went into the enclosures, we gave them a mouse physical, tested many of the measurements that, you know, people would have tested at the doctor's office. And there was no difference in body weight between the sugar and the control animals. There was no difference in most fasting blood measures. And when we did see a difference, it was only two things, and they were very minor differences, nothing that would have raised flags at all. So these mice went to the doctor's office, passed their physical, then went into the real world and couldn't cut it.
Which shows something is going on in a sort of deep molecular level that you need to figure out, right?
Exactly. And right now, our molecular characterizations are done at those high doses.
Yeah.
And it's likely that some of those things are going on and perhaps our tools are not capable of detecting them right now. But it's also likely that the mechanisms that go on when you eat kind of a normal level of sugar are going to be different than when you eat high levels of sugar.
So so you've just gotten started, really. I mean, this initial information raises tons of questions.
That's right. This is the first potential toxicant that we studied. All the rest of our studies had been on genetic anomalies like inbreeding.
Yeah.
And so we have this long-term vision that it could be a very useful screen for potential toxicants in food supply, environmental contaminants, pharmaceuticals, etc.
So it's not just sugar you're going to explore. You want to sort of get into other kinds of things. I guess the question would be, since we are talking about sugar, though, James or Wayne, can you translate this? Is it too early to translate this into sort of how much sugar a human should have? I mean, what kind of, what did you learn about the way humans should be consuming or shouldn't be consuming sugar through all of this? Or is it too early to say?
Well, what we do know is that about 80% of substances that are toxic in humans are also toxic in mice.
Yeah.
And so
we can translate that in some way.
That's right. Much of the physiology is similar, 80% genetically identical. And so it's likely that similar processes are going on in humans. And so we think the main experimental bridge will be to discover the mechanisms that are causing the mice problems.
Yeah.
And then we can take those mechanisms to humans to see if they're being perturbed when you're on these various diets.
Yeah. Gosh, are you intrigued to find out, I mean, what is going on in the molecules of a mouse and a human that makes the mortality rate for female mice, that's pretty significant.
Yeah, it's really exciting and also disturbing, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
of course, I
would have loved to have actually found nothing. I'm not excited that sugar is causing a health problem,
right?
It was good for my dissertation, but, one of our big hopes now is that all of the armies of mechanistic molecular cellular scientists will now look at our report at these large organismal findings, which are complex, and help us, right, and on their own help characterize what's going on. And then we'll know what's going on at the cellular, at the molecular level, and we can look for that in people. But until then, right, I think we just have to ask ourselves, what is the prudent choice right now?
Right.
And I think the prudent choice is we know this causes a problem in mice at this level, which is moderate. Right? It likely causes problems in people at this level. There's lots of epidemiological data showing that sugar consumption is associated with many human disease states. And so I think at this point it's prudent, right, to be concerned about sugar intake until on the off chance that this is a mouse-specific problem, that evidence is shown. Until then, the safe bet is assuming that it's a general mammalian phenomenon.
So go ahead.
We do like to ask the question, if it poisons a mouse, do you want it in your body?
It's a reasonable question. Let me ask you this finally. So how has it affected the amount of sugar you guys have been eating in a normal day? Has doing this actually affected the way you look at sugar in your own life?
Yes, I've cut back, but it's primarily affected my 15-year-old son, who swore that as soon as this paper would publish, he would go cold turkey on the sugary drinks. And so today he's gone cold turkey.
How's he doing?
Withdrawal.
Yeah. James, what about you?
I have tried actively to produce more of my own food, including more of my own baked goods, because it is difficult to get away from sugar if you're purchasing processed food. And you'd be surprised when you bake cookies on your own, how much less sugar there is in those cookies than when you buy the same thing at the store. Yeah. So kind of taking control and determining for yourself how much sugar is in your food is a path I've taken.
James Ruff, he is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Utah, along with Wayne Potts, professor of biology at the university. Their study on the consumption of sugar at supposedly safe levels was published today in the journal Nature Communications. And gentlemen, congratulations. Thanks for joining
Thank you.
Us.
Thank you.
We'll take another brief break. When we get back, one of the preeminent experts on this idea of sugar, Dr. Robert Lustig, will join us. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sugar. We've talked a bit about the history part. We've also talked about what sugar is doing to us. A couple of researchers from the University of Utah talking about the research, which shows that it's doing more than just making us fat. We invite you to join the conversation if you like. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Robert Lustig is joining us now, a pediatric endocrinologist at UC San Francisco, the head of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health Program there, author of the book Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Food, Obesity, and Disease. And he's joining us today from his office in San Francisco. And Dr. Lustig, welcome.
And I'm happy to be with you.
Great. We're grateful. Well, I wanted to start with this study from the University of Utah. I'm not sure you know much about it, but the idea
I've
that—
I've read it.
You did. So this must be— you must be quite pleased with the results. That they seem to be confirming things that you've already thought about.
Well, let's put it this way. This is an animal study. And I will tell you that animal studies and human studies don't necessarily all go together.
Right.
However, it is certainly very supportive, and I want to congratulate Drs. Ruff and Potts for a superb job of putting together various threads in the literature and really finding something really remarkable that really needs to be followed up on and may have very, very significant implications for human public health.
Mm.
Having said that, it is still an animal study, and we have to, treat it as such. The fact that these animals did show very significant changes, early mortality, changes in behavior, changes in fertility, at doses of fructose normally consumed, and indeed, these are normal amounts. The fact is that our adolescents today are consuming 335 calories a day in added sugar. Mm. That is approximately 2.5 cans of soda per day. And this occurred at 3 cans of soda per day. You can see that we are very much within the confines of normal, rational consumption. The thing is, we are above what is considered rational consumption by triple at the moment.
Mm.
The American Heart Association said that we currently consume 22 teaspoons of added sugar per day and that we needed to reduce that to 6 to 9, 6 for women and 9 for men. And currently we're at 22. So you can see that we have a long way to go. The food industry will counter that by saying, all of these studies that have been done have all used excessive doses. Well, that's because you only have a short period of time to keep people on experimental diets. You can't do these kinds of studies in the field in humans.
Mm.
So I applaud the Utah team for doing what they did in animals and letting it go to all the way to fruition, mortality,
yeah.
Which is really what has to be done.
Before we get to the particulars of what it is that sugar is doing in our bodies, I wanted to talk about a strain of thought that you yourself have talked about, and that is how political the dimensions are to this story. I mean, you've talked about For example, in the Nixon administration, how he asked his secretary of agriculture, Earl Butz is his name, to take food out of the political equation. I guess, were you surprised at how political this story seems to be? Because that seems like the place to start.
In fact, the exact phenomenon that Nixon said was exactly what Ruff and Potts found in their study. Hmm. The fact is that sugar makes you weak. It makes you less able to mount an aggressive response against an opponent. That is exactly what Ruff and Potts found in their study in terms of how the males dealt with it. And there's a reason for that. Hmm. It's because your brain thinks you're starving.
Yeah.
Well, the fact is that sugar stops political unrest because you don't have the energy to engage in that political unrest. The fact is that as we have turned toward a sugar-based diet, we have experienced enormous medical problems, but those countries that have the highest levels of sugar consumption have the lowest levels of political unrest, and those with the least have the highest.
Hmm.
So there is, in fact, not just an inverse correlation, but a mechanistic role that sugar plays in terms of how it dampens brain function.
Another critical moment you've talked about and written about is the advent of high fructose corn syrup. This comes from a Japanese scientist in 1975.
Absolutely. This expanded the amount of sugar that we were able to put into foods because it made sugar cheap. Up to 1975, sugar was a relatively expensive commodity and was used in relatively sparing dose. But with two things that happened, one, the advent of high fructose corn syrup, which made sugar cheap because it provided competition for cane sugar, and also the switch from fat, away from fat, because of the low-fat directive of the late 1970s, this meant that sugar started being applied into all of our foods. In big ways, in ways that we would never have anticipated and were never studied prior. Now, I am a great believer in the statement, the dose determines the poison.
Yeah.
The question is, what dose of sugar is safe? And the answer to that is probably 10% of calories is sugar. This was a dose that was promulgated by the World Health Organization back in 2002. And the fact is that our Health and Human Services Director Tommy Thompson, along with his assistant, William Steiger, went to Geneva and extorted $400 million from the WHO if they published that report. And it was deep-sixed. It was called Technical Report Series 916. And it's all over the Internet. You can find it yourself. The bottom line is we've known what a dose of sugar that makes sense is. We are so far over that because of governmental directives to basically keep us complacent. It's often, you know, as Karl Marx said, religion is the opiate of the people. Well, Karl Marx never met high fructose corn syrup.
What effect did all of these political dimensions have on the price of sugar? Because one thing you've said is that high fructose corn syrup, for example, isn't, you know, necessarily biologically evil, but it's economically evil.
That's right. High fructose corn syrup is the same as sucrose in all of the empiric studies that test them head-to-head.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, high fructose corn syrup is either 42 or 55% fructose. Fructose is the bad guy in this story. It's the molecule that's metabolized differently. Glucose does not appear to be the problem. In fact, the complex carbohydrate that Ruff and Potts used in their control diet was glucose.
Right.
So we do not think that glucose is the problem. Every cell in the universe uses glucose to function. Fructose is another story. Fructose can only be metabolized in the liver. And when you provide it in excess, the liver has no choice but to turn the excess fructose into liver fat. And that drives all the chronic metabolic diseases that we know about. And we have shown that fructose is the proximate cause of type 2 diabetes worldwide. It is not a randomized control trial, but it is the same causal medical inference that we had for tobacco and lung cancer. And I stand by that wholeheartedly.
Mm.
The fact is that what high fructose corn syrup did was it allowed for our dose to go up. so that we ended up exceeding that 10% of calories as sugar. And now we are seeing the ravages of the chronic metabolic disease that excess fructose delivers. And it's breaking the bank. Mm. And we just don't have the money to pay for all of this. It has often been said that we wouldn't need health care reform if we had obesity reform. The fact is we can't have obesity reform as long as our food supply continues to ply us with environmental toxins such as excessive sugar.
When you talk about the metabolic dimensions of all of this, it gets to a central point that you talk about all of the time, which is this idea that a calorie, in fact, is not a calorie.
That's right. A calorie is a calorie if you're talking about physics. If you're talking about energy balance, a calorie is a calorie. The problem is obesity has nothing to do with that. Obesity has to do with biochemistry because those calories have different metabolic fates. And I can prove it to you, four different examples. First one, fiber. You eat 160 calories in almonds. How many of those calories do you absorb? The answer is 130. So what happened to the other 30? The fiber in the almonds prevented the early absorption of those calories so that the bacteria in your intestine got them instead. That ended up changing the microbiome, the types of bacteria that are in your gut. They chewed up the calories. You didn't get them. And so a calorie is not a calorie because what you ate and what you absorbed were two different things.
Right.
How about protein? Turns out it costs twice as much energy to metabolize protein to turn it into energy than it does to turn carbohydrate into energy. So you lose 100 calories a day metabolizing protein, whereas you don't with carbohydrate. So a calorie is not a calorie.
Yeah.
How about fats? So we have omega-3 fatty acids, which are heart healthy and prevent dementia, and we have trans fats, which are the devil incarnate and cause cardiovascular disease at remotely low levels. In fact, trans fat free doesn't mean trans fat free because you can label your food trans fat free if it has 0.49 grams of trans fats per serving. And if you eat four processed foods in a day, you're getting dangerous amounts of trans fats despite the fact that you think you're avoiding it. A calorie is not a calorie because omega-3s are not trans fats. They both burn calories at the same rate, but they are clearly not handled the same. And then finally, fructose and glucose.
Yeah.
And that's where I've done the research, where I've done the work, and where other people, are clearly supportive of that statement. A calorie is not a calorie. Mm. As long as a calorie is a calorie, the food industry wins because they can then divert attention. They can say, well, I'm sorry, you didn't burn it because you didn't exercise. Or it's not just our fault. It's any food with calories, as Coca-Cola's Coming Together commercial just espoused. But if a calorie is not a calorie, and there are different calories that impact your health differently, then we should be altering our diet and our dietary composition to allow for the good calories and not the bad ones. The problem is we subsidize the bad ones and not the good ones.
It's interesting. You talk about the fact that we know this stuff. But the fact is people are there's one thing you've talked about, for example. Let me use this an example, what you call the Coca-Cola conspiracy.
Yep.
What you talk about, the amount of salt, that seems to be the sort of crucial dynamic in the Coca-Cola conspiracy. They know how this stuff works.
Right.
But explain that, if you would.
Well, all right. I on the YouTube video from 2009, I basically said that, soda has three things in it. It has caffeine, which causes you to lose water. It has salt, which causes you to gain sodium.
Yeah.
And that makes you thirstier. So why do they put so much sugar in Coke is to hide the salt. You can't tell that there's any salt in Coke. In fact, you can't tell that there's half soy sauce in any sweet and sour pork recipe because the sugar cuts the salt. It's called increasing the salience of a specific item. It turns out sugar increases the salience of fat. So the people who eat low carb eat high fat, yet they lose weight and they are metabolically healthy. But the people who eat high fat and high carb are the people who have metabolic syndrome because carbohydrate alters the salience of fat.
Mm.
And that is true certainly for sugar. Which would you rather have, a Cinnabon or a Pixie Stick? The bottom line is you put these different nutrients together very specifically to make something that people want to consume. And the ultimate version of that is Coca-Cola.
We're getting some very particular questions. 801-585 West, by the way, is the number to join the conversation. Karen has been waiting in Park City. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi. I don't buy any processed food for my family, but I do like to make desserts. And I'm wondering what type of sweetener is the safest for me to use in baking, making ice cream, that sort of thing.
Right. Everybody wants to know. So if sugar's a problem, what should you do? I'm not going to tell you that diet sweeteners are any better, that's for sure. In fact, there's some new data that's come out in the last 3 months from various sources that says that diet sweeteners may be also be problematic in their own way. What I would suggest to you, Karen, is very simple. Sugar is okay in low dose. Dessert is fine once a week, not once a meal. Yeah. The food industry has made dessert once a meal by making one of the first three ingredients a version of sugar. They have basically turned everything into dessert. Chinese chicken salad is dessert. You know, when you think of it that way, it changes the entire dynamic. Go ahead and make your desserts. My wife bakes. She's Norwegian. I can't stop her. But she makes, when she makes cookies, she reduces the amount of sugar that any recipe calls for by one-third, and the cookies come out better. You can taste the chocolate, you can taste the oatmeal, you can taste the nuts. They actually are, they taste better, they are better, and your kids will love them better. Try that.
Mm. Karen, thanks very much for the call. One from Troy, who's wondering, and I'm sure you get this question too, Dr. Lustig, this idea of fruit. Right. Where does fruit fit in the scheme of things?
Right. I'm on record as saying fruit is okay. And the reason fruit is okay is because the sugar in fruit is mitigated by fiber. The fiber reduces the rate of absorption so that your liver has a chance to catch up. In addition, the fiber will reduce some of the absorption so that the bacteria in your gut will get it instead of you. So both ways, your liver is protected, and it's liver fat that drives chronic metabolic disease. So whole fruit is just fine, and I've said so. Some of my detractors make fun of me for, you know, saying that fructose is toxic when whole fruit is perfectly fine. The reason is because when God made the poison, he packaged it with the antidote. The amount of sugar in any given fruit is commensurate with the amount of fiber, and that's on purpose. If you look at berries, they're relatively low in sugar, they're relatively low in fiber, and you work all your way all the way up to sugar cane,
yeah,
which has the highest concentration of sugar. It's a stick. You can't even chew the damn thing. So the fiber mitigates the negative effects. Fiber makes fruit self-limiting. You can't overdo it. And so whole fruit is fine, just don't turn it into fruit juice or smoothies.
Mm. We're getting questions about artificial sweeteners, which you mentioned. Let me come back to that. You mentioned problematic. But by that, what do you mean? That it gives us it makes us want sweet things, or that it in fact has a direct implication on our insulin levels?
Both.
Both.
It makes us want more sweet. Sweet makes want more sweet at the level of the reward center of the brain, in that sugar has been shown to downregulate dopamine receptors, which are the feel-good neurotransmitters. They're the reward neurotransmitters. So if you downregulate those receptors, you need more dopamine to accomplish the same level of reward the next time around. That's the phenomenon that we call tolerance. And tolerance is the first step on the way to addiction. And sugar, for lack of a better word, is weakly addictive. It is not addictive in everyone. It is only addictive in some, just like alcohol, but in the same way and for the same mechanisms and for the same reasons. So there are sugar addicts. Not everyone is a sugar addict. That's true, but not everyone's an alcohol addict.
Right.
And not everyone is a nicotine or even a caffeine addict. But the bottom line is these are addictive substances because they drive dopamine receptors down. So more sugar means more sugar yet. And, of course, more sugar yet means liver dysfunction, chronic disease, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and ultimately early death, as Ruff and Potts showed in their mice.
Yeah. So is there a difference between you here? You see different kinds of compounds in these different kinds of artificial sweeteners, aspartame and, you know, the stevia plant. Is there any difference in any of those, or is the point just broadly apply the point?
We just don't know.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to know about diet sweeteners. To be honest with you, I want to know about diet sweeteners.
Right.
There's a reason we don't know. It's not because we are too stupid to know. It's because the data doesn't exist. Here's why. So there's something called pharmacokinetics, and there's something called pharmacodynamics. They are not the same. Pharmacokinetics is what your body does to a drug. Pharmacodynamics is what a drug does to your body. They are not the same. The FDA requires all the pharmacokinetics for all the diet sweeteners because pharmacokinetics tells you about acute toxicity, the toxicity where you keel over as soon as you are exposed to something like cyanide or sarin or ricin or something like that. That's pharmacokinetics. Pharmacodynamics has to do with chronic toxicity, and that's actually the assay that Ruff and Potts used for their study that was in Nature that you've just elaborated on. The FDA does not require those chronic toxicity studies. It says in its own charter, the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act of 1938, that they're only interested in acute toxicities. So the FDA doesn't demand those studies be done. So the food industry says, well, those studies can't help our sales, and if the FDA isn't going to demand it, we're not going to do them. Yeah. And then the NIH says, well, this is the food industry's job. We're not going to pay for it. So we have an FDA who doesn't ask for it, a food industry who won't do it, and an NIH who won't pay for it. No data.
Another central point, let me ask you this finally, is you say this is up to us. You've been trying to recruit people. How do you feel it's going right now?
It is going reasonably well. I have to say things have really turned. There have been a few things that have made things turn. But there is a general perception amongst the populace that things are not going right and that the dietary advice that we have been fed by the Food and Drug Administration, by the USDA over the last 30 years is clearly not in our best interest. And by exposing how the food industry has manipulated that information, it has become very clear to a lot of people that we need to make big changes. It's become clear to the medical establishment. It's become clear to a lot of the general public. I would say also that Obamacare has redrawn the lines of engagement. It used to be that it was the doctors against the lawyers, the doctors against the insurers. Well, now, because of Obamacare, it is now the doctors, the lawyers, the employers, and the insurers, because they all have something to lose, against the food industry, the drug industry, the White House, and Congress, who have a vested interest in keeping things the way they are. So we now have new recruits to the fight, and they are relatively powerful, influential people who wield a fair amount of money. I would say that the battle is going reasonably well.
That's Dr. Robert Lustig. He's the author of the book Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Foods, Obesity, and Disease. Joined us today from his office in San Francisco. Dr. Lustig, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West, production of KEWR News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.